Morning, everybody. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, please. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We're going to finish this chapter this morning. We're going to begin in verse 17. That's where we left off. Verse 17. Of the context of this chapter, and let me just suggest to you that the subject matter does not change throughout this entire chapter. While there's various segments and very different nuances of the subject that are discussed, it's still the same subject, and that is questions that they have asked Paul regarding celibacy and whether or not they should be celibate, whether or not that is a higher spiritual lifestyle. And of course that is affected by various relationships, whether you're married or unmarried, and divorcing from a, whether you need to get divorced from a pagan, all those things are discussed. And so the first little section, he first of all says, married couples, no, you are not to be celibate in your relationship. That is not what God has called you for. And part of the point of being married is to be able to fulfill those sexual urges that God gave you. And then in 6 through 9, he speaks through to the unmarried. Those who have never been married before would be the implication, and widows. And they can remain celibate if they want to, but he's certainly not placing any kind of restriction on that or being giving a command about that. But if the sexual urge is too great, they do need to go ahead and marry. In verses 10 and 11, he speaks to those that are obviously Christians, because the next section is dealing with those who are married to non-Christians. But he makes it very clear, divorce is not allowed. And Jesus has already taught on that subject. He doesn't really need to go into great detail. So if you're married, stay married. And then that also applies even in the case of if you are married to a pagan, if you're married to a non-believer, still, you stay married. You do not initiate a divorce. It may very well be that they had the thought that they were becoming defiled by being married to a pagan, and so he says, no, the matrimony is holy, the marriage is still holy, and so do not divorce your spouse. Granted, if they initiate a divorce because of your faith, because you're a Christian and they don't want you to be, and let them go, you're not a slave to them. You don't have to give up your faith because of that. They cannot make those kind of demands of you. So let them go. And now we're going to come to 17 through 24, which is kind of a this middle section between the first half and second half of the chapter, which really is the principle by which everything he has already said is based, and also the principle upon which everything he's going to say is based. So let's read 17 through 24, and then we'll make some applications. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And so I ordain in all the churches. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it, but if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. Okay, so at a cursory glance, you may wonder, what on earth does circumcision or being a slave have to do with this subject matter that he's been dealing with marriage and celibacy? And then if you skip ahead in verse 25 and following, he returns to this subject of marriage. So what does circumcision and slavery have to do with anything? Well, the fact of the matter is that it's just an example. Those are just examples. take a look at three places in which he states the principle upon which everything is based. Beginning in verse 17, he says, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And then in verse 20, let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. And then in verse 24, brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. So the principle is you stay in whatever state you're in, whatever relationship you're in, that's what you do. You don't change that. You don't seek to change that in any way. Okay, so apply that back to what we've already discussed in the first half of the chapter. Okay, if you're married, then the natural relationship should include the sexual relationship. So Paul's point is, you keep that up. You don't change to be a celibate relationship. Even though you're still technically married, don't change to live celibate lives. If you are, if you're married, don't seek a divorce. Don't change that, even if you're married to a pagan. Don't seek to change that. And even if you are unmarried or a widow, he said his preference is that you remain unmarried, although he does concede that you're certainly free to marry if you like. And so that's the underlying principle, is you stay in whatever state you're in. But let's take a look at the examples that he uses. He talks about circumcision in verse 18 and 19. Who is it that would have been called, that is, became a Christian, while they were circumcised? Who would that be? What group of people? Okay, that would be the Jews. And then those who were uncircumcised would be everybody else, the Gentiles. Right. Steve? Steve's question is, was this instruction from God to the Jews, which of course goes all the way back to Abraham, was this done to distinguish them from the Gentiles, or did it have a health benefit? Was there some purpose behind it as far as health is concerned? And the answer is A, it was strictly a sign of being separate and distinct from the rest of the nations. I do think there is a metaphorical purpose behind it as well, that Paul actually uses in Colossians 2 in verse 11 when he equates the circumcision of the heart, or he uses that metaphorical language, where cutting off the sins of the flesh is an act of circumcision. And so there's that underlying metaphorical sense to it, but it was not for health reasons. It was one of those things that would be a very visible distinguishing sign of the Jews versus the Gentiles. And it was, and as he tells Abraham, it's a sign of that covenant that he has made with Abraham and his descendants. So why is it that sometime, or that he would say, was anyone called while circumcised? Well, let me back up. Let me do the second question first. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. So in other words, a Gentile who would be uncircumcised, he says, don't be circumcised. Knowing what we know about the issue in other parts of the New Testament, what would Paul be referring to there? Why would a Gentile even consider being circumcised? Okay, asked to by the Jews, and I think we can even use stronger language than asked. In some cases, it was being demanded, wasn't it? And commanded by what we refer to as Judaizing teachers. What is the underlying principle or teaching that the Judaizing teachers were promoting? Okay, they couldn't be part of God's kingdom unless they were circumcised, which means that they had, basically they were doing what? They were becoming a Jew first, right? So they had to proselytize to Judaism first. And yeah, you can be a Christian, but you've got to be a Jew. And Paul, this is the main issue that Paul has to deal with during his ministry. Is no, you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to become a Jew. You do not have to proselytize to Judaism. Judaism is no more as far as the laws are concerned. And so circumcision and other markers of, you know, keeping or not eating meats and certain meats and so forth, all that is gone. And so he's telling the Gentiles, you were called while you were a Gentile. You don't have to become a Jew. Were you uncircumcised? Then you stay that way. Now, the other side of it, which is actually the first question he asked, is were you called while circumcised? Do not be uncircumcised. Okay, there was an actual physical surgical operation that Jews could undergo, and many of them did during the Hellenistic movement. That is, when the Greeks were moving through the area and establishing their culture. And many Jews did undergo this process of surgical process of appearing to be circumcised. Why would a Jew want to do that? Especially when, you know, that's supposed to be a sign of the covenant. But why would they want to do that? Okay, Lisa says to fit in. That was the case with Jews that were not comfortable being different from the rest of the nations around them. Talking about. And so you don't have to become like a Gentile, he says. It doesn't matter whether you're circumcised or not. As he goes on to say in verse 19, that's nothing. It means nothing anymore. Just keep God's commandments. That's what matters. Okay, yeah. It could be done out of pride. That could be one motivating factor for that. So don't change your condition, and circumcision is just an example. The overall subject matter, though, is celibacy and marriage and how all that relates depending upon your circumstances. He's using circumcision as an example that if that doesn't matter, and if you can serve God, whether you're a Jew by birth or whether you're a Gentile by birth, whether you're circumcised or not circumcised, then that's the case with marriage as well. And so don't change your situation. You can still serve God regardless of what situation you're in, marriage-wise is concerned.
Have you ever heard anyone use these verses to try to justify
saying? Absolutely, and that was where I was going. Good segue. Thank you very much. I planted that seed ahead of time. What Becky is asking is, have you ever heard somebody use this passage as justification for staying in an adulterous marriage? Let me back up. What we're typically talking about is people who were not Christians, divorced for a reason other than sexual morality, got remarried, so not a scriptural marriage, as we would call that, but then was taught the truth, taught the gospel message, and wanted to become a Christian. There are those who say that that marriage, while yes, that divorce and that marriage, while it was sinful, that those sins are washed away at baptism, and at that point on, their marriage would be acceptable in God's sight. I do not believe that's what the Bible teaches at all, but there are some who do believe that and will appeal to, at times, 1 Corinthians 7 to justify that. What say ye? Excellent, excellent point. That is one of the passages that I use too when talking about that situation. And that is John the Baptist, when he is talking to Herod about his adulterous relationship with his brother's wife, the easy solution would have been, well, just become a Christian, be baptized, and it'll take care of all that, and you can stay in that relationship. And he says, no, it's not lawful for you to have her. All those other passages don't just go away. And you can, of course, liken it to other sins. Somebody that's a thief. Well, okay, yes. Will their past thievery be forgiven at baptism and when they confess those sins and ask God for forgiveness and come to Him? Will those be forgiven? Can he continue in that lifestyle? No. He can't continue in that. What about homosexuality? Let's say somebody's involved in homosexuality. I believe all of us here understand that that would be condemned. So, at baptism, does that mean that they can continue in that lifestyle? No, because it's not just a matter of getting wet. There's the repentance that must take place. And that was an adulterous marriage. Repentance would need to have the fruits worthy of repentance, which would mean getting out of that illicit relationship. Good question. Go ahead. Becky says that the argument then is the volley coming back is, but it's a sin to get a divorce, and so we shouldn't do that. Actually, there are examples in the Old Testament, in it's either Ezra or Nehemiah, I think it's Nehemiah, where there were Jews that had violated God's command about marrying pagans. And guess what they had to do in order to repent, to show that they were repentant? They put them away. They divorced. They sent away their wives and their children from those marriages. That was part of the repentance process. And so while God hates divorce, when you're in a relationship that you shouldn't be in the first place, the divorce is actually the part of the solution to the problem. So, yes, Paul says three times in this section, whatever state you're in, you need to stay in that state, but let's not take that out of the context. Part of that argument that Becky is talking about is this taking these passages out of their context. That's not at all what Paul is talking about. Paul is discussing their questions of celibacy, and in fact, he's the divorce that's mentioned there, he says no, you don't divorce. As long as it is a proper relationship. So, whether it be circumcision, and then he also uses the example of slavery. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but let me just quickly ask you, why doesn't Paul condemn slavery here? That's something that, especially in recent days, has come up with the Confederate flag and what it stands for. And us in our enlightened culture, we understand that slavery is wrong. So why didn't Paul here, or even in the book of Philemon, which was written about a slave, Onesimus, returning to his master Philemon, why doesn't Paul, or any other New Testament writer for that matter, condemn slavery? Okay, Terry says, one option is that slavery was not condemned by God. Okay? What? But Steve says it's not condoned by God either. Okay? Inspiration didn't tell him to condemn it. Okay? Okay? Chris says that it's a different type of slavery. That is true, that the slavery of the 1800s in the United States, there were some dramatic differences between that and what you find in the first century. That doesn't mean to say that, the slave masters were obviously all kind and gentle and did the right thing by their slaves. Far from it, as a matter of fact. Okay? So we do need to be careful when making comparisons. That is true. Terrell? Yeah, he makes that point here in this very passage, is that, we, and he does it in Romans 5 and other places, that we are slaves to Christ. So, say that again? That's right. We have been bought with a price. And so we are indebted to Christ. Okay, James? Is 1 Corinthians 7 a thesis statement about slavery? Or, I mean, is that the subject material of 1 Corinthians 7? No. And especially of these verses? It's a matter of, the subject matter is, it doesn't matter what condition you're in, you can still serve God. His point is not to try to condone or condemn slavery. It's just a matter of fact, that's the way it is. And you can still serve him regardless, Brother Rich. And I think you're right. But Paul does just use that terminology to make a theological point. That is true. Steve? Yeah. When you're a slave of Christ, you're voluntarily submitting to that. Right? But based upon the debt that you recognize you owe. Here's the thing. Was Christianity begun and the teachings of Christianity taught to try to absolve the world of all of its social issues? Not at all. And, you know, while there's nothing explicit one way or the other condoning or condemning slavery in the Scriptures, that's not Paul's objective. Paul's objective is not to try to clear up and eliminate any social issues. It's not about poverty and trying to bring the people up of lower status up to a higher status, and that's not the objective of Christianity either. Now, as we have opportunity, we do good to all men, of course, and we help those in need, but the Christianity does not solve the world's social issues, including slavery. And so his point here is it doesn't matter whether you're a slave or not. You can still serve God. You don't have to try to change your state, in other words, to serve him. Now, he does give an exception here that if you have an opportunity to become free, then sure, do it. You can serve God, and maybe even better while free. But you can certainly serve him while a slave. And again, slavery is not even the main issue here. He's talking about celibacy and marriage and those relationships, and he's using this as an example that since you can serve God whether you're Jew or whether you're a Gentile or whether you're a slave or whether you're free, then the same applies to whether you're married, whether you're unmarried, and whether you're married to a Christian or married to a pagan. You can still serve God. You don't need to change your state. You don't need to change your relationship. That's the underlying principle that he's getting at here. And that's why three times, at the beginning, in the middle, and the end of these verses, that he makes that point. Okay? Questions or comments about any of this? Hang on one second. I'm sorry, Linda. Mm-hmm. Okay? Right, right. And, you know, we were slaves to sin, like you said. We were in bondage to sin. But as he goes on to say here in verse 23, you were bought at a price. Speaking of Jesus paying, redeeming us from the cost of sin and that slavery of sin. And so, like whoever said a while ago, you know, we then voluntarily submit to Jesus as our master because of what he did for us. Okay, good point. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And that's the preferred way of doing it. You know, God doesn't, just because you have the right to divorce your spouse if they have been unfaithful, certainly doesn't mean you have to. And it's better if you can work it out. That is absolutely crucial. Thank you. Right. Right. Doesn't mean it's wrong if you do. But we would hope, and I think that God would hope that the marriage stays together, but you certainly have that freedom to divorce if that's the case. Matthew 19. Okay, any other questions? Okay, the subject matter does not change. He's still talking about celibacy and marriage relationships. There in the middle, he has given us the underlying principle by which all of this is based. Let's continue on now in verse 25. Oh, let me share with you the way I word it is just remain in whatever state you're in. You can serve God no matter what condition you find yourself in. So let's take a look at 7 verses 25 through 40 now. Now, I'm going to warn you, depending upon your translation, it may read a little bit differently. I don't remember which translations insert the word daughter in here. The word that's in Greek is virgin, but in some of these verses, your particular translation may include the word daughter, probably in italics. Words in italics in your translations usually mean that those are supplied by the translator to help fulfill or help fill out the translation. The word is not there in the original Greek, but is put there by the translators. The word daughter is not in the Greek. And if your version has that, as we read through these verses, that's because they take a particular view of the interpretation of this passage to be about a man and what he is to do with his daughter that is a virgin that may be betrothed to be married. The other main view is that this is not talking about a man and his daughter, but rather just the virgin herself as she is betrothed to be married. And so the word daughter would not be present. Okay? All right, so let's read. Verse 25. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loose from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But even if you do marry, you have not sinned, and if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh, but I would spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is short, so that from now on even those who have wives should be as though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use this world as not abusing it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be without care. He who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. Right here in verse 34, I'm reading from the New King James. You're going to notice a big translation difference. New King James says, there is a difference between a wife and a virgin. Your other translations will say, but something along the line of, and he is divided, continuing the thought from the previous verse. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she is past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and has so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then, he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. Okay, there are, like I said, some translation differences here, and differences in opinions from the scholars as to exactly the relationship being discussed. And there are some various nuances to all this, but what is the big picture? Keeping in mind the entire context, even the first half of chapter 7, that middle section where he gives the main principle, what is the main point of this section? What is he trying to say about these virgins or virgin daughters, if you take that view? How would you summarize it? It's the same thing. Stay as you are, right? That's his judgment. It's, in his mind, it's better if you stay in that state, which in this case, when we're talking about women that are betrothed to be married, would be to stay single. Okay. So it's best for those who are engaged to hold off getting married, but he does make it clear, if you go ahead and get married, you haven't sinned in doing that. But it's his judgment that you'd be better off if you did not get married. Now, why does he give this judgment? What is it that he says is his reasoning for holding off on the marriage? Okay, due to the present distress, he says that in verse 26. Some of your versions may say difficulty or something of that nature. What is the present distress that he's referring to? What is the difficulty that... Okay, that would be my first thought, is that he may be referring to some type of persecution that they were enduring or were going to endure. Now, there is no indication in either 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians or in Acts, as Luke details his journeys and his time in Corinth, that there was any kind of persecution that they underwent. So there's that question of, okay, well, it sounds like there may have been some kind of persecution, some kind of difficulty along those lines, but yet we don't have any hint of it anywhere other than maybe this one verse, if that's what it's talking about. So we don't really know exactly what he's referring to. Go ahead, Ben. And it may very well have been. We just don't have enough information about the situation. There is something, though, that they would have recognized, they would have known what he's talking about, that is would make it difficult. And he alludes to this, I think, in verses 29 through 31, where he says the time is short or compressed, is the way some translations say it. And some take these verses as being kind of eschatological in nature, and that is that, hey, the world is coming to an end soon, Jesus is coming back, or maybe he's referring to some future persecution that's going to be coming upon them that he knows about, because he is, after all, inspired by God, and so he wants to save them from that. I don't think he has the end of the world in mind here. I don't think Paul viewed that present time as, hey, Jesus could be coming back any minute. I mean, it's going to happen during our lifetime. I think that in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, he makes it very clear there were certain things that had to happen first that were going to come. The man of sin, man of lawlessness that was talked about there. All those things have to take place first. And so mean, he knew it was going to be a while, a little while at least. And so, in any case, it seems to me, though, that he does have knowledge of some kind of difficulty, maybe persecution, that he's trying to keep them from. Why would that be a problem if they got married? Tactics, yeah. Fast forward 10 years from the time that he writes this letter, and Nero is on the throne at that point. And what do we know about Nero and the Christians in Rome? What are some of the things he did? Okay, he burned them at the stake. He used Christians to light his palace. He set them on fire and used them as human torches. What else did he do? Say that again. Fed them to the lions, okay, the arena and so forth, those games, okay. Now, if they threaten me as a Christian and say, you either give up Christianity, you deny Christ, or else you're going to be fed to the lions, while I wouldn't look forward to that fate, I would hopefully say, let it be. But then if they grab Lisa and Penn and Jonathan and Casey and say, you either give up Christ, deny Christ, pay homage to the gods, or we're going to feed them to the lions, that's a whole other situation. That changes things a little bit and tugs the heartstrings a whole lot more. Makes it more difficult, doesn't it? Okay. So somebody that's single doesn't have to worry about those types of things. Doesn't have to worry about the persecutions or problems that come about, that can come about as a result of the Christian faith. There is another reason he gives in this section that we already talked about actually a couple classes ago. Why else would he desire for them to be celibate in this particular instance, to not go ahead and get married? Take a look at verse 32 through 34. What does he bring up there? If you're married, then what's on your mind? Things of the world specifically relating to your spouse. And you've got a responsibility as a husband to please your wife, or as a wife to please your husband, to take care of those things, right? Now, those things are not wrong. Those are, in fact, part and parcel with the marriage relationship that God has condoned and blessed you with. But as it says in verse 34, if you have a translation other than the New King James, it says your interests are divided. That is, you've got part of your time that you're dealing with your family, taking care of those obligations, and that limits the amount of time you can spend in service to God in some way. Paul chose not to be married. And think about all the things he did. Everywhere he went, the time he put in, the efforts he put in. Do you think he would have been able to do all of that, I mean, every bit of it, if he had a wife and kids? It would have been extremely difficult for him to do that, wouldn't it? But by being single, he was able to focus his efforts and his mind completely on the ministry that he was given by Jesus. And so that's why he says, you know, my wish would be and my judgment would be, especially in light of this present distress, difficulty, whatever it is, that you remain unmarried. And one of the benefits of that is you can then serve God even more. You can do even more than you could if you're married. Okay, so, but he is quick to point out it's okay if you do go ahead and get married. Next week, I want to finish up this last part of the chapter. Just a couple of points that need to be brought out. One is I want to discuss in a little bit of detail, just to kind of give you both sides of the view here about whether this is talking about virgin daughters or talking about just the woman herself who is engaged to be married. I mean, who is the man here? Is it the father he's talking to, or is it the fiance? And then also we need to talk about the widow and her remarrying in verse 39 and 40. There are some questions about that that we can look at. But be ready to talk about that, and also we'll get into chapter 8 and talk about chapter 8 next week. Thank you, guys.